You may be seated.
Our next case is 13-711, State of Ohio versus Jeffrey Ballew. Mr. Hardwick.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm here with amicus counsel for the Ohio Suicide Prevention Foundation and Disability Rights Ohio. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Jeffrey Ballew was a United States Marine in Iraq during the surge. During that time, he had to deal with children trying to kill him and had, as one of his duties, picking up the body parts after firefights and explosions. He lived in constant fear, such constant fear that one way he dealt with it was what he called 50-50ing it, living each day as if he had a 50% chance of dying before tomorrow. Now, he came back from Iraq. He didn't have any physical injuries, but he did come back with a damaged mind. And as a result, and that constant fear came back with him, first to Camp Lejeune and then back to Oregon, Ohio after his discharge.
Counsel, let me ask you a question because this troubles me on this case and I'm trying to figure out where we're at. When the trial court says, pursuant to the report, the defendant does not meet the criteria for a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity, what does that mean?
Well, that's absolutely correct. It means that he is morally responsible for his action, that he understood right from wrong, and that his mental disability did not prevent him from understanding right from wrong.
No, I guess that's not my question. My question is, was the court at that point saying, I have reviewed the plea and found that you don't get it?
I don't think so. And first of all, if she did say that, it was preliminary because it was before Dr. Graves testified at the sentencing hearing. It was based on the bare record that she had at the time. And Jeffrey Ballew has never contested that what he did is a very serious offense. Yes, he did initially plead not guilty by reason of insanity, but there's never a statement from him saying that what I did was okay. No, he always admitted that it was wrong. Even to Dr. Castle, who at the beginning he said, I admitted what I did was wrong and I shouldn't have done it. It was irresponsible to carry a gun when I was drunk. But the question in this case is mitigation, not excuse, which is one of the trial court's mistakes. And part of the reason why it's so clearly a mistake is that fear, when it traveled back to Ohio with him, it manifested itself in ways that are very typical of post-traumatic stress disorder. He'd wake up in the middle of the night hiding underneath a table. He couldn't let go of the gun that the Marines always told him he had to keep with him, that he was nothing without a gun. He would sleep with it at night. Sometimes he would point it at people in his sleep, and his family would have to wake him up to tell him to stop. Sometimes he would even forget to take it off when he took a shower. That's how difficult things were for him, and it's not surprising they had trouble keeping a job. One way that he dealt with his PTSD is because he didn't have any psychological counseling available to him. He self-medicated with alcohol, and he would just drink till the fear went away, and the fear didn't go away till he passed out.
Mr. Hardwick, you've presented a very cogent and compelling argument on behalf of your client. But where do we come up with, how do we get the guidance? Justice O'Donnell's favorite question is, what would you have us write? I'm not going to steal that from him, but
go ahead.
But if we're sympathetic to what you're telling us, how do we articulate the guidance?
Well, first I would start with my proposition of law, which was, when credibly diagnosed, a trial court has to consider post-traumatic stress disorder in mitigation.
And you feel the record indicates no consideration was given.
Because she said, you claim you have post-traumatic stress disorder, but that's no excuse. And even in the explanation of why she wouldn't consider it as an excuse, which she never tried to argue it was, she showed that she had just such a fundamental misunderstanding of what it meant to be a United States Marine, especially one.
What was in the record to demonstrate that he did have PTSD?
That it was both the report and the testimony of Dr. Graves. And Dr. Graves found in his report that Mr. Ballew had post-traumatic stress disorder. Some of the symptoms that I already said, he also had problems. Anytime he heard He'd get terrified every time he heard someone speaking a foreign language. He couldn't cope with daily life coming back. And
so we can give guidance here. What crosses my mind, and I know we all struggled with this when we had the Franklin County judge who seemed to enjoy dramatic headlines and gave 150 years to the guys that were down in German Village robbing people and making them strip and doing a lot of bad things, and also outside that case had committed murder in another, you know, unsympathetic defendants, but 150 years. And the question before us was, is that excessive? And the difficulty as we try to analyze that is how do we articulate how much is too much? And we're, this is a different version of it, but it's the same problem, isn't it?
I actually think it's a different problem because in Hairston, the issue was Eighth Amendment. It was an Eighth Amendment claim. And I think 2953, I think, gives this court guidance as what to do. It says first that that what an appellate court should do, especially when reviewing consecutive sentences and the findings behind them, is decide whether the appellate court, in its own judgment, finds that the record does not clearly and convincingly, finds clearly and convincingly.
So our focus should just be the consecutive sentence.
Well, first,
the choice that the judge made here.
Yes, and also when it comes to the range within the 3 to 10 year range, there's still an abuse of discretion standard. And I think this is an area where there truly is a conflict of laws. And appellate lower courts are all over the map in terms of how do we review trials. Some of them take what the state's position is in this case, which is as long as it's within the range that it can't be an abuse of discretion. And I think
your argument is really that the trial court abused its discretion in the sentencing. Is that your case? Is that your position?
There are two different, the record does not, the record clearly and convincingly does not support the findings for consecutive sentences.
But we're bound by what the legislature instructs should be considered at sentencing. And as I'm understanding it, and you can correct me, 2929.12c4 says that the court shall consider all the following that apply, one of which is there are substantial grounds to mitigate the offender's conduct, although they may not constitute a defense. So that's something the court, we could determine if it did or didn't consider. But your proposition says a court must consider combat-related post-traumatic stress, which is what the court may follow the statute and consider. But you're asking us to sort of legislate, are you not, by putting something into this statute that wasn't there?
No, and the trial court isn't just required to consider. We never just say, well, trial judge, let me just take an example of a relevancy objection. The range of possible decisions, rulings resulting after a relevancy objection go from admitted to excluded. No appellate court would say, well, the trial court didn't abuse its discretion simply because it cited the right rule and made a decision within the range.
Well, on March 22nd, 2929.12f was modified, and it now says the court shall consider the offender's military service record, whether he has an emotional, mental, or physical condition traceable to the service in the armed forces, and whether it was a factor in commission of the offenses. But that wasn't the law at the time of this sentencing, right?
But yet, right, but the catch-all was
so are you delayed. Asking for a retroactive application of the amended?
No, I'm asking for the
subsection
application.
Subsection F?
I'm asking for an application of the catch-all provision. And as the United States Supreme Court—
When you say catch-all, what are you referring
to? The catch-all, the one that says any other mitigating factor. There isn't any other mitigating factor that—
Substantial grounds to mitigate the offender's conduct?
Right, and the United States Supreme Court in Porter v. McCollum expressly held that this country has a long history in affording our veterans leniency in sentencing. Now, he's not asking to be let off. The minimum sentence he's entitled to is 10 years in prison, and he readily accepts that as a fair minimum punishment.
So, counsel, if we went where you would have us go, we would say those cryptic remarks by the judge at the beginning of this process indicates a failure to seriously consider all the things that the judge was supposed to consider, reverse for resentencing, and then you could extrapolate from other cases that we're dealing with or have dealt with recently, that if you go back and the amendment to the statute that Justice O'Donnell just read would now be in play because that's a benefit.
Right, it would be.
So if we reversed and there was a resentencing, the paragraph he read would be in play.
Right, and I don't think it's too much to ask for the trial court to even to try to get it right on this, to get it right, because as I said in
the
brief—
The tricky part you would acknowledge is we have, 700 common pleas judges and a lot of municipal judges sentencing defendants every day, and for us to be second guessing when they're choosing within the ambit of the ranges that they're given, that's really quicksand for us, isn't it?
Well, first of all, this court is a court of law and doesn't have to accept any of those 700 if it doesn't want to. But think about that's what the General Assembly gave appellate judges for. There are only 9 judges in this country who don't have another judge looking over their shoulder on something. And even when the standard is abuse of discretion, appellate judges deal with that all the time. Did the trial court abuse its discretion in making that hearsay?
Would you concede, though, that if we did decide to reverse and remand for resentencing on this, that the trial court could say, I have taken into consideration the provisions of 29-29-12F and give him the exact same sentence?
I would say under these facts, I would be appealing saying that the record doesn't support it, unless there's something new that came up.
Well, this is a pretty compelling record in both directions. One is the life that has been led by your client and what he's been exposed to from a very early age, you know, is pretty horrific. But his response to that has also been pretty horrific. It's like the extremes in both directions. And, you know, not all veterans that come back with post-traumatic stress disorder act in the way that your client has acted and are as dangerous to those around them, their community, and ultimately law enforcement, the way your client has seen, you know, fit to deal with his PTSD. Was he under psychiatric care at the time?
No, he's never been.
Was he in the Veterans Administration services? Was he seeking any kind of help?
He cannot. He is ineligible
because
for
of a dishonorable discharge.
Not a that's wrong. It was a bad conduct discharge. Dishonorable discharge is for the worst of the worst.
Okay, so bad conduct discharge. Is he eligible for services under that?
No, not unless he can get that changed. The irony.
Has he petitioned to have that reclassified?
Not that I know of, and I do know that right about a year after he left, after he was discharged, Congress changed the law and said that people like him who credibly show post-traumatic stress disorder, that has to be considered at the court-martial.
But they also have the ability to revisit that in the military.
It's a long process, and the VA is just starting to figure that out now.
Counsel, aren't we missing something in this case as well, though, is that ineffective assistance of counsel, you've raised it in your arguments, that there's nothing in this record. You're making a very compelling case here today of why 27 years is not fair, but there was nothing before the trial court. You got 2 doctors who said not eligible for NGRI, but I don't see any psychologist or psychiatrist or military counselor that was brought in and said, look, this guy needs help.
Actually, Dr. Graves, that's exactly what Dr. Graves, he's not a military psychologist, but he did say, yeah, this guy needs help. And to get help, he would need, given the combination of problems, he would need very active outreach to help pull him in. This isn't the kind of thing that people with these problems don't just go in and ask for help. People like this need help to be brought to be thrust upon them.
But counsel, we have a statement by the trial court that says that she read, it says, I've reread Dr. Wayne Graves' report, that she had read all the documents, read the PSI, I mean, is your, in terms of what the chief asked you about, if the judge had said, I've looked at that particular provision and I still give the same sentence, why is that different from what she said here, where she said, I've read everything, I've looked at the record, I've considered it, but I'm not going to let it affect your sentence?
Because first of all, we've never said the standard of appellate review is, I've listened to the arguments and I made a decision, therefore my decision is unreviewable on appeal.
But if one of your issues is a trial court must consider PTSD, it sounds like this judge did that.
Well, she also, I guess we shouldn't have to include the word, the adverb properly when we talk about what a trial judge should do. She said expressly on the record things that made it clear she didn't get it. She said that he was, the part of the reason she held it against him, that one of the things he told Dr. Cassell was one of the reasons he joined the Marines was to quote, see how many people he could kill. Now, first of all, she missed the first two-thirds of that, which was the brotherhood and camaraderie. But she also missed the fact that that was not the 18-year-old Jeffrey Ballou who went into a Marine recruiting station and signed up to give 4 years of his life to his country. That was the 24-year-old Jeffrey Ballou who talked very consistently with the way United States Marines talk, who'd been through training where he was taught exactly what he was taught. He was taught to kill people efficiently, to break down that natural human inhibition to kill people. And if you talk to United States Marines, they will tell you part of their job is to kill people and to do it well and to do it often. And that was what he said.
Under the appropriate circumstances.
Correct, but that's the way Marines talk. And I have a quotation from a lieutenant colonel who was a Marine judge in Guantanamo who said, yeah, that is why people join the Marines.
But Mr. Hardwick, when you add the word properly, and you say the word properly, it seems to me that you're disagreeing with the conclusion of the judge, which is different, as Justice French has said, from the consideration of the factors. And don't we have to look at the appellate review standard, which is under 2953.03G2, it talks about the court may reverse if there's a decision contrary to law. Here we have the consideration stated by the judge, stating, I've reviewed this material. This is my conclusion. As the chief has said, there's information regarding your client's actual work in the service, the problems he had there beforehand. And the court makes that conclusion that I find this is the appropriate sentence. When you say properly, it seems that you're talking about the conclusion.
Yes, that's what appellate judges do all the time. And
but that's that's different from contrary to law.
But contrary to law, also, and as this court said, it's in the dissent in Kalish, and I can cite the dissent because the dissent is as much as law as the lead opinion in that case. If the judge doesn't properly consider the factors, it is contrary to law. And secondly, under the 2953.08, the clearly and convincing standard, that permits, that, in fact, that order that tells appellate judges that they are supposed to exercise their own judgment. This court is supposed to exercise its judgment. Do I think that this record clearly and convincingly does not support what this trial court did? And that the legislature is telling appellate courts, use your judgment. And even under the abuse of discretion standard, just considering the right statute, considering the right rule, never doesn't give a judge, doesn't.
But the statute that we're talking about, the G2, says the standard for review is not whether the court abused its discretion. Specifically says that's not the standard. It's the contrary to law, or if the record does not support what the trial court has said.
Well, if I remember Your Honor's dissent in Kalish, it said that the trial judge is required to properly weigh what was the purposes of sentencing, and if they don't, that's what contrary to law means. Contrary to law should not be equal to void ab initio. Contrary to law shouldn't be just within the range. Contrary to law is when a judge doesn't properly follow the rules, doesn't make the right decisions and balancing them. And yes, I disagree with her decision, but that's what appellate courts are supposed to do. Appellate courts are supposed to decide whether the trial court got it wrong. And sometimes it's a very deferential standard, but I'd argue under this case it is arbitrary, unconscionable, and.
But what do you do with a judge who said, I'll consider the factors, but I reject the factors, which seems to be what the court did here, saying, I realize you claim you suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, and you provide that as an excuse, but there is no excuse. So the court has said, I recognize what the claim is, but I'm rejecting it.
Actually, she misstated the claim, and he never claimed that this was an excuse, and that was, he never claimed that this was an excuse. There's a huge difference between excuse and mitigation. Excuse says what he did was okay, we're going to give him a pass. He's never asked for that. He has admitted from the beginning that he is responsible for this very serious crime. He needs to be held accountable.
Well,
he deserves
I'm sure
to be
the court,
prison.
As the Chief Justice alluded, had to consider the fact that there were shots fired at uniformed police officers in response to an emergency call. I mean, this is not your ordinary circumstance. These are serious charges.
But it's actually the ordinary circumstances of this charge. In his crime was elevated to a first-degree felony because the victims were peace officers, and his specification is 7 years because he used a firearm.
Well, he wanted to shoot police officers. He said when he found out that they were going to be, that they were called, he specifically said that he will shoot the cops. Yeah. And upon their arrival, you know, he pretty much ambushes them by shooting at the cars, you know, as they pull up.
Well, his full statement was, I'm going to shoot the cops and fucking kill myself. That's what he said.
Well, I understand that he was going to orchestrate his own demise. And it's one thing to plan on killing yourself, but if you're going to try and take out others along with you, you know, that's a problem.
And that's why what he did is a first-degree felony, and that's why his spec is 7 years, not 3 years. And that is, these facts are already taken into consideration in the definition of the crime. Elements are not sentencing enhancements. And is an element of this offense that the victim was a peace officer, is an element of the specification that he used a firearm.
So is your problem with the discretion exercised by the trial court?
Both the discretion and that this court, in an independent review, should find that the record does not clearly and convincingly does not support the findings of the trial judge because she got it so wrong in so many different ways. And even pointed out that she said that part of the reason she held it against him that he still committed a crime while he was back on the base after his time in Iraq, as if PTSD is triggered by discharge papers instead of by the combat that he'd
already
received.
How does a resentencing in this case benefit your client in your view?
Well, first of all, we will presume that the trial judge will read this court's opinion and will give more weight. It will properly consider the mitigating factors of his post-traumatic stress disorder, that she'll have at least some sort of education on how that works. And also, he's now in a prison unit specifically designed for veterans, that he wouldn't be in if he had bad, if the prison thought he was particularly dangerous.
But the court would still have the same discretion to impose whatever sentence in line with what the legislature has said the punishment is for this offense.
Although I would point out that she said 27 years is the appropriate sentence without considering post-traumatic stress disorder. So I'd argue that it would be hard, that I would be arguing that she needs to be arguing down from there once considering it.
And Dr. Graves gave him a diagnosis of PTSD?
Yes.
There's an actual diagnosis in the report.
Yes, actual and major depression as well.
Okay.
You're
right. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Dave Cooper, and I'm an assistant prosecutor from Lucas County, Ohio, representing the state of Ohio. The trial judge in this case did review the PSI. She read Dr. Castle's report twice, once in connection with the NGRI, and secondly in connection with sentencing. She read Dr. Graves' report twice. She permitted Dr. Graves to testify at length at the sentencing hearing. She read two letters from the defendant's mother. She listened to the defense attorney's statement. She listened to the defendant's statement. She stated both in the sentencing hearing and in her judgment entry of sentencing that she had balanced the seriousness and recidivist factors of 2929.12 and the principles and purposes of sentencing under 2929.11. She made findings both in the sentencing hearing and her judgment entry of sentencing as to why consecutive sentencing should be imposed.
Counsel, I want to ask you, because we're on to an important subject here, The question has been asked, if this court were to reverse this sentence and remand it, would this individual be entitled to the new statute that's been enacted?
I think so, yes.
The new statute would apply?
I think so. But the point I tried to make in my brief is that Judge Jennings did consider, was as though that statute, it's actually, I think it's 2929.12F, which was added after the sentencing. I think she made it clear that she did consider the PTSD. She didn't say, I don't believe Dr. Graves. I don't believe that he has PTSD. She didn't say, I don't count his military service at all. She said, I considered those. And although I did, I still think this is the appropriate sentence.
Was there a reference to 2929.12C4 that the court shall consider substantial grounds to mitigate the offender's conduct?
Yes, exactly. And that is... And
what was the mitigation that the court articulated it considered at the sentencing?
I don't think she specifically articulated any mitigation. And your decisions have said she doesn't have to do that. She doesn't have to set forth on the record the calculus of her decision making. She doesn't have to say, well, I consider this a mitigation, I consider this as being a recidivism factor, I consider
this. Is there a place in the record we can determine whether or not the court referenced the post-traumatic stress disorder condition of a veteran?
I believe there is. And I believe I quoted it in my brief. Now, did she articulate it in an eloquent fashion? No, but I think what she said and what is pretty clear from the record is, I have considered these things, and...
Did you say that was incorporated in the sentencing opinion?
Pardon me?
Was that incorporated in the sentencing opinion?
No, I don't believe it was. But what was incorporated in the sentencing opinion, in the sentencing JE, was I have considered 2929.11 and 2929.12. She didn't articulate specifically what she considered. And I think there are, we tend to forget that there were some factors that cut against mitigation. And one of those factors was his criminal record. And I think the appellant kind of poo-poos the criminal record, but he had misdemeanor adult and misdemeanor juvenile records, and also misdemeanor charges that were dropped before this that were mostly assaultive crimes. In the military, he was still in artillery school, basic training in artillery, when he assaulted another recruit.
So you're saying that his problems, many aspects of the problems materialized before his deployment to Iraq.
Yes.
And there was a tendency towards violence in his desire to get into the military for the camaraderie or whatever else you want to say. But even at that point, before being exposed to the military philosophy and the Marine philosophy and whatever, he did articulate that his desire was to kill.
He did. He did.
And he had
articulate
an alcohol and substance abuse problem before he went to Iraq.
That's correct.
But you don't disagree that it was exacerbated.
I do not
by
disagree.
By his military deployment.
I do not disagree, and I don't think Judge Jennings disagreed with that. She just said it doesn't cut that much of a factor, in my opinion.
If the judge had given him the maximum here, what would it have been?
34 years.
34 years. So this is a downgrade of 27 years from the maximum of 34.
Yes. And he got 1 7-year firearm specification. Had there been no plea bargaining, he could have gotten both of those, and those would constitute a factor in when he would qualify for judicial release. Because the way I read the statute, if he had been convicted of both firearm specifications, because keep in mind, he fired at two police officers, he would have had 14 years. Mm-hmm. And since his non-mandatory sentence was over 10, he would have had 19 years to serve before he would qualify for judicial release. Under this sentence, he can get out, or he can at least apply for judicial release after 13 and a half years. So he did not get the maximum sentence, and he got a pretty good break on when he can apply for judicial release. So I guess what bothers me about this case is, what do we tell the judge if the case was reversed and sent back to the judge? She might very well, I don't know what she would say, but she might very well say, hey, I already considered these things. I considered them back in 2011 when I sentenced Mr. Belew. And this is the sentence I think is appropriate. And simply sentence him to the same amount of time. So, and I don't think anybody in this courtroom can describe to me, because I pondered it many times, what is the difference, really the essential difference, between a sentence which is clearly and convincingly not following the law and a sentence which is an abuse of discretion. Supposedly, an abuse of discretion gives the judge more leeway, but I don't know. I think it's a distinction without a difference without much, or a distinction without much difference.
Mr. Cooper, you'd agree, though, that the standard for appellate review is under 2953.08G2?
I do. And that talks about whether the sentence is clearly and convincingly contrary to law. But I think any time a trial judge, has to say, well, I'm going to give him 3 or 10, or something in between, or I'm going to give him 10 and 10 as consecutive sentences, how can that not be an exercise of discretion? And if it is an exercise of discretion, then it must be subject to an abuse of discretion standard. So I think imbued in that 2953.08G2, there has to be some exercise of discretion which this court should honor, because it is no matter which standard is ultimately chosen by this court, it is a highly preferential standard. It gives preference to the trial court's decision because, after all, the trial court saw Dr. Graves. She saw the defendant. She read these reports. She has firsthand information about this crime and what the appropriate punishment is.
And you're saying the record states that she said, in every respect, that she considered these factors that have to be considered.
Yes, and I think she did in her sentencing, during the sentencing hearing, she said that she considered these factors, and she said it again in her judgment entry. So, and I mean, what else can we do but believe her? She did, she said she did. We have to assume that she did. If there are no other questions, I will.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hardwick.
Your Honor, I'd like to correct two factual errors that came out. One, Your Honor said that he said that his purpose for joining the Marines was to kill people before he joined the Marine. That's wrong. He said that after. He said that at age 24. That was what the 24-year-old Jeffrey Belew was describing as his motivations to be in the Marine. He did not say those words when he was 18, when he was a high school student. I respectfully say that's incorrect. And also, as to the plea, on page 5 of the plea agreement, defense counsel said that, pursuant to our discussions, we understand the maximum sentence would be 27 in this case. It would be 27. We're looking at a 7 to 27. He was corrected, and the prosecutor pointed out that it was 10 to 27 was the range people agreed on. In theory, he could have gotten 34, but the range the judge was thinking of was 10 to 27 at that point.
Well, what do you mean? What's the difference between in theory, which I'm presuming you mean according to the statute, he could have gotten 34, but the judge was considering?
But it looks like it happened to the plea agreement was that in return for the guilty plea, that they were decreasing the upside potential of it.
Which is what she gave him.
Right. But that was still the, it was not an agreed sentence. It was, if you plead guilty, we won't go above this. And all he is asking in this case is, he just wants one fair shot to have the trial judge to consider how the injuries he got in Iraq in combat serving us helped and contributed to him being out there on that cold April morning with a gun in his hand, shooting at officers and hoping to die. He wants that one chance, and that's all I ask this court for.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision.